Welcome to the Perpetual Motion Machine for Thursday, April 9, 2020. I'm your host, Dennis Schaefer, and I am calling in from home. Hopefully this is going on the air, and I hope I have my guest. And part of the problems that we have is that we're in kind of a lockdown mode. Most of the people that put on your shows are not at the station. And one of the reasons for this is because of the COVID-19, we have to be sort of self-isolating. So what does that mean? We're social animals, and we need each other for well-being and support. So let's try to see what the psychological effects of COVID-19 might be. Hopefully, we got Karen Smith as our guest. Karen is a postdoctoral fellow.
So this is Shali. But what's the topic of your show today, Dennis?
The topic of the show is what the psychological effects of COVID-19, particularly dealing with social isolation, and what that can do to you psychologically.
All right. Well, why don't you start off by telling us some of the psychological effects?
Well, the main one is that I can figure out is stress. And stress is a very complex and broad term that could refer to anything from anxiety to depression to nervousness. Being socially isolated can lead to maybe even things like stir-craziness, jitteriness, just trying to be able to function on your own by yourself. Sometimes that means a family as well, and that can be stressful, having to hunker down with your family as well. But stress is the main thing, and I wanted to ask Karen about what that does to a person's mental and emotional state to see whether that can lead. I guess loneliness might be a common side effect of that as well. And so that's what I kind of wanted to talk about with her tonight. Karen, hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing good. Let me just ask you right off the top of the list here is, like, you know, basically social isolation. And that's what we're kind of having to do. What kinds of burden or what happens basically when to a person, particularly over time, I would imagine, because we've been sort of self-isolating for about, you know, 4 weeks or so. You know, what does that do to you psychologically and emotionally, mentally?
Yeah, so I think it is really important right now to distinguish between sort of physical isolation, which is what we were doing, which is what we are doing, and social isolation, which would be not connecting at all socially with people. Because there's still plenty of capacity for us, even though we're physically isolated in our homes, trying to social distance to prevent the spread of COVID-19, to connect with the people we care about and interact with the people we care about, especially in the current day and age, given all the technology we have. But at the same time, I do think the physical isolation, it does put us at greater risk for sort of perceiving ourselves to be isolated as well. And when we think about the health consequences of social isolation, it's really perceived social isolation, perceived lack of quality social connections that drives the mental and physical health outcomes associated with isolation. And that's what we refer to as loneliness. And so, I mean, some of the health consequences that have been associated with loneliness include altered immune functioning, which I think is very relevant right now, given that that can make lonely individuals more susceptible to disease. It also includes increased mortality. Perceived social isolation is associated with increased risk for mortality comparable to things like smoking and obesity. It's also associated with increased risk for psychopathology, especially things like depression and anxiety.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. One thing that I kind of thought of when I was kind of putting this together, and I always kind of came back to the same thing as stress. I know stress can be sort of a very broad term, but is that sort of the effect that happens?
Yes. So loneliness is acting as a stressor, and it elicits a lot of the physiological and behavioral and psychological consequences associated with stress. And again, when we think about stress, it really is it refers to the psychological response that's elicited when an individual perceives an event. And this can be like a real event in the world or something they're imagining or worried about in the future as a potential threat. And I think the current situation we're in, there's not only this potential for sort of perceiving yourself to be so socially isolated associated with the pandemic, but the pandemic itself, I think, is acting at a population level as a fairly extreme stressor, especially because it's associated with a lot of the things that make experiences and tend to influence perceptions of stress a lot, including a lack of perceived control over the situation. I think a lot of people are feeling like they don't have control over the situation because, I mean, we don't have that much control over what's going on, as well as a lack of predictability associated with what's going on.
That's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that because, in a sense, you know, self-isolation or being socially isolated is sort of counterintuitive to our human nature in itself. But because of what this pandemic is doing, it creates uncertainty beyond, everyday life. And that adds a lot more to the problem, you know, psychologically, I think. You know, like you said, you have no control.
Right. I think it is. It's sort of, when we think about stress classically, there are a bunch of sort of experiments that were done in the 80s and 90s where they looked at stress responses in animals and like changed whether or not an animal had the ability to control the stressor or predict the stressor, and that dramatically shifts stress responses across pretty much all stress systems. So I think it is, it's sort of there's a number of factors associated with the pandemic that have the potential to result in sort of extended chronic stress for the individual that could have negative long-term outcomes. However, I think I also want to emphasize that when we're talking about stress, even though colloquially we often think of stress as a negative thing, stress in of itself and loneliness in of itself are not actually negative things. They represent adaptive responses to perceived threats in the environment and are associated with shifts in physiology and behavior aimed at addressing those perceived threats. So I think one thing to recognize as we're all sort of isolated in our own apartments and houses and might be experiencing feelings of loneliness is like what the purpose of those feelings are. So that's a signal to the individual that you might lack social connection, lack good quality social connections at the moment. And so using that to sort of motivate yourself to reach out to other people, to call friends you might not normally call, to interact in ways we are able to interact with the people we care about, can be a good way to maybe shift how we're thinking about the feelings we're experiencing.
Yeah, in other words, just sort of refocus something else to have a different mindset, pretty much.
Right. Like recognize that it's serving a purpose. And, I mean, I think also recognizing the fact that we're not, although it can feel like we're alone in the current situation, we're not actually alone in the current situation. It's something that's being experienced throughout the United States as well as throughout the world.
That's a good point.
So there is a lot of shared common experience right now.
That's right. That's what kind of, it's a sort of a good way of looking at it, that we have all, everybody around has one thing in common. we're still all the same, you know. It's like we have to deal with this pandemic, and we're all dealing with it the same way.
Exactly. And I think the other thing to recognize when you might be feeling this way, and I think it's an important thing to sort of know and think about, is that sort of feeling socially isolated, perceiving yourself to be socially isolated, is not only associated with sort of these negative long-term health outcomes, but it also is associated with more immediate shifts in attention to negative information in your environment. So right. Lonely individuals tend to be more attentive to cues of negative emotions. And so also right. Recognizing that that might be happening can help you sort of, well, maybe I'm interpreting the situation in a way it's not necessarily, it's not actually been like being meant to be interpreted. So like if you got like a text message from someone that felt kind of short and you took it personally, maybe you're over attentive to the negative information in those messages, and recognizing that can help you sort of address the feelings associated yeah. with that.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what some things you can do, but let me ask you this, you know, a couple things first. You've got a lot of technology, and this what we tried to do tonight didn't work, unfortunately, with Google Hangouts. But we have, you know, all this technology. I mean, Zoom, everything's been, you know, Zoom and FaceTime. But that doesn't necessarily, I mean, that provides a certain kind of social interaction, but it doesn't provide the physical kinds of connection that you might, you know, that people need. Is that good enough? I mean, you know, with the technology that we have, is that actually be enough to make us feel less isolated?
I think it can. I think it can help a lot. I think there is a lot to be said for one-on-one interaction. There are cues you're not getting over video that you are getting when you're in the same room as someone. But again, sort of the negative effects of social isolation are really associated with that perceived quality of your relationship. And you can get a lot of that validation about the quality of your relationships through the mediums we have through the technological mediums we have today. And I think a lot of it is about just reaffirming that you have people who are, they might not physically be in the same room with them, you might not be able to see them for the next month, but you do have people who care about you, who are checking in on you, you're checking in on them, and you're continuing to bond over common experience, and you can still have these very high quality relationships even if you aren't in the same place with people. And I think more and more, as the world, as technology has advanced so rapidly over the last 20, 30 years, we're getting more and more used to connecting in that way anyway.
Yeah. I know. We've done shows on social media and some of the drawbacks that can provide too, unfortunately.
No, it's true. It's not perfect. But
no.
I mean, I have a collaborator who did a study looking at sort of emotion contagion, and specifically looking at stress contagion, so sort of how we respond to viewing other individuals who are stressed, and even just viewing videos of individuals who had just undergone a stressor, you see both affective and physiological contagion across that medium in the individual viewing them. So obviously we don't want to try and exacerbate the feelings of stress that everyone is feeling right now, but I think the idea is that it does seem like some of these, a lot of the cues we use for to sort of think about others' emotional states and interact with other individuals and have shared experiences do translate over some of the technological mediums we have.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. This is probably my pessimist side talking. Could there be a breaking point that someone could feel so stressed out that they get you know, maybe mental, you know, whatever that happens mentally. It was some sort of breaking point.
I mean, I think it is, like, when we think about stress, we often refer to it as an inverted U, where you sort of have this upside-down U shape. Too little stress is a bad thing because you're not motivated to do anything. Too much stress is also a bad thing. And I think it's definitely the case that this situation has the potential for some individuals to be a very negative chronic stressor that eventually leads to that could lead to severe mental health issues in terms of depression or anxiety about the current situation. And so I think for that reason, it's important for us not to only be like reaching out for ourselves, but to also be reaching out to the people we care about and making sure they know someone's out there who cares about them as well.
Yeah, exactly. I had a colleague who's no longer with us, had schizophrenia, and he would call me. He lived alone, and he was a colleague on the show. And he called me. He would call me 3 or 4 times a day, just to be, you know, to have a voice, you know, to connect with. That was it.
Yeah. And I do think right now that's especially important for all of us. I mean, I know I'm talking with my family, and I mean, a lot of my friends aren't actually in Madison, and even them, I'm talking to a lot more frequently than I was before we were all socially isolating.
Let me ask you this, and I you know, I was going to ask you about what people can do, and you brought up about reaching out and helping other people. How does that help relieve the stress? Does that, for you know, for you, does that make you sort of change the narrative, you know, where you're not thinking about yourself and what's wrong with you, but thinking about somebody else and changing your mindset?
Yes, I think it does, and I think, so sort of loneliness can be a very difficult thing to intervene with, but the interventions that have shown promise and sort of shifted perceptions of loneliness have been those that focus on those types of techniques, focus on trying to shift cognition and how you're thinking about your environment and your relationship. And I think it can be helpful to people maybe to think about loneliness in the same way you might think about hunger. So both are sort of basic motivations, right? Because we're social animals, we do need social connection and social relationships for survival, and evolutionarily that has been the case. And so that's part of the reason loneliness can have such dramatic effects, because it is signaling this lack of something that's important to individual survival, in the same way hunger is signaling that. And so when we're hungry, we will go to the refrigerator and get food. Obviously, that's not as easy when it comes to sort of social connections, because we don't have a refrigerator we can go to and pull friends out of. But we can recognize that it's a similar sort of drive, and work on maintaining and building the social connections we have. And I mean, one of the people who's done a lot of the research in loneliness, in the loneliness field, John Cacioppo, would always talk about how in some ways it is a lot easier for us to connect about now that we have the internet and social media, because there are a lot more ways to find individuals who have common interests, which is, I think, a big part of sort of building those social connections, because again, it can't be just anyone, and it's not about the number of people you have around you. It's about the quality of those relationships you have.
Right. Right. Maybe, and I'm not part of the social media stuff like Facebook or anything like that, but a lot of information has come out about, you know, helping, you know, food drives, getting, you know, the healthcare workers, helping them in various various ways. But yet, you know, you think that maybe you could use social media to create, you know, groups of people where they can, you know, all interface each, to each other. Maybe not just within your own community, but maybe, you know, across different parts of the country, even somehow, maybe something in common. You know, music has been, you know, some of the things with music have been, they've been doing, you know, impromptu, you know, home concerts with in group, you know, like through Zoom in the standard mm-hmm. group stuff, whatever that is. But yet, you know, you could, that would be an option for people to do that can, you can continue after this pandemic goes away.
Right, exactly. And I think the thing the pandemic has done is sort of facilitated a lot of creative ways for people to continue interacting for things that would normally be sort of in-person social experiences.
Yeah. Let me ask you this before we run out of time that I've okay. heard about. Two of our colleagues, Kelly and Ari, brought this up in a previous show. Was I think, I'm not sure if this is the right way of describing it, virtual therapy, that that a person who might feel, you know, over the top, stressed out, could connect with maybe a counselor or a psychiatrist for a one-on-one online session. Have you heard about this?
Yes. So I think a lot of clinicians and therapists are, I think there was a move towards trying to make virtual therapy more accessible to people prior to the pandemic because it can be helpful to reaching high-risk individuals in very rural areas or very right. impoverished areas that might not have access to therapy. And so I think the pandemic is sort of forcing clinicians and therapists to move online and interact with their patients that way because I think mental health is especially important right now because there are a lot of, there is this extreme amount of stress associated with the experience and we are all alone in our apartments. And so it has sort of pushed for more rapid integration of virtual therapy platforms, from what I understand. I myself, I'm not a clinician. I'm trained as a researcher.
Yeah, I know. Are you aware of any of those that you might be able to pass along or not?
I am not currently aware of any in Madison. I know of friends who have continued therapy who are working at other institutions, but I'm sure I could, I would bet the University of Wisconsin has information on their website about ways people can try and access therapy right now.
Do you have any other suggestions you might like to share that where people might be able to go? I'm assuming online mostly, but...
Yes, I think mostly looking online and looking at the types of resources the university has available as well as the health system has available. I know a lot of the healthcare groups have provided a lot of information about how you can receive care through telecommuting, and I think therapy is one of those options for a lot of them.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed
it. Thank you. Okay. This has been another edition of the Perpetual Motion Machine, as rough as it was tonight. Thanks again to our guest, Karen Smith, for joining us. I also, again, want to take extra time to thank Chally Pittman. She tried to help us tonight. She engineered the show. Without her and the others at the station, PNM, and all the other news and public affairs shows could not be on the air. I can't express enough of my gratitude for her help. I'm your host and producer for the show, Dennis Schaefer. Next week's Perpetual Motion Machine, we'll talk with virologist Kristen Bernard about the nature of pandemics. Lonesome hours, space invader, blasting through the night.